If I could have some men help me, that would be nice. These are yours, Cliffy. Thank you, gentlemen. All right, almost everybody has notes. Let's all stand, please. For you that like history, anyone that likes history, of course, everybody likes their own history, likes to talk about themselves, but I'm talking about history that has nothing to do with you. Something made you interested in history, and I can tell you exactly what made me interested in history. Battle of Thermopylae. You say the Battle of who? And the battle before that was the Battle of Marathon. Some of you have even heard of the Marathon. You think it was a race. No, it was a battle. Where a guy ran from the plains of Marathon to the city of Sparta to get help. And the Spartans, if you know anything about the history of the Greeks, there was no such thing as Greece. There were Greeks. And they all hated each other. So the Spartan says, we're a little busy, we're having a party. We'll see you later. That's the Battle of Marathon. Tonight, I'm going to at least introduce you to this because if you desire, you'll actually understand how it fits into the book of Esther. Unless you think there are information in the Bible that's not significant. Chapter 2, verse 1. After these things, when the wrath of King Xerxes, and I'm just going to put Xerxes there, I can't pronounce the Hebrew form of it, was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. Now you're going to find out in a few minutes, this is 4 years later. A person that thinks would be asking, what in the world has he been doing for 4 years without a wife? Or without his best wife or whatever she was. Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Susa, modern way of saying it, the palace, to the house of the women, unto the custody of Hege, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women, and let their things for purification be given them. ESV translates that differently, but it's the idea of, you know, he wants them to go through a whole long process. So again, they please Xerxes. By the way, I want to say this. I thought about this, and I should say it. Now, I'm older, so some of you are not old enough to remember this, but all the old ones are. How many of you grew up saying Beijing? How many of you grew up saying that? None of you did. You grew up saying Peking. And somewhere along the line, we found out they didn't say Peking, they said Beijing. Many names change. They're still the same name. You got it? I think Peking, folks, you don't remember back that far. You're looking at me funny. My goodness, that was all of history. Peking. It's been Beijing probably since the 80s. You just can't remember back before. Sushan is simply Okay, I'm sorry, I'm speaking. You guys have your own opinions. I'm just trying to share simple things with you. Things change. If you go to India today, it's Mumbai. And a whole bunch of different names. Things change. Shushan was the Hebrew way of saying Susa. That's all. That was as simple as that. All right. So we continue. Let's look at verse 7. It says, and he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter. So it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together into Susa the palace, to the custody of Hegai, that Esther was brought also into the king's house, to the custody of Hegai, keeper of the women. And the maiden pleased him, she obtained kindness of him, and he speedily gave her the things for purification, which such things as belonged to her, and seven maidens, which were meet or appropriate to be given her, out of the king's house, and he preferred her and her maids unto the best place of the house of the women. And Esther had not showed her people, nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. And Mordecai walked every day before the court of the women's house to know how Esther did, what should become of her. Now when every maid's turn was come to go into the king Xerxes, after that she had been 12 months, according to the manner of women, for so were the days of their purification accomplished, to wit, that is, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with sweet aromas, we would say, not odors, and with other things for the purifying of the women. Then thus came every maiden unto the king, whatsoever she desired was given her to go with her out of the house of the women unto the king's house. In the evening she went, and on the morrow she returned unto the second house of the women, to the custody of this poor guy, and the king's chamberlain, which kept the concubines. She came in unto the king no more, except the king delighted in her, and that she were called by name. Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was come to go in unto the king, she required nothing but what Hegai, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the women, appointed. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all them that looked upon her. So Esther was taken unto King Xerxes into his house royal in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year. By the way, the first reference we have is in the 3rd year. We're 4 years later now. He's been without a queen for 4 years of his reign. And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast unto all his princes and his servants, even Esther's feast. And he made a release to the provinces and gave gifts according to the state of the king. Verse 19 is the oddest verse in the book of Esther. We'll talk about it a little bit later. What I want to do is I want to look really tonight at Mordecai. Chapter 2 introduces us to Esther, but Esther in chapter 2 is what's called a flat character. You don't know anything about Esther until you get to chapter 4, when her personality starts to show. In chapter 2, it's more about what Mordecai's doing, and that he was the father of Esther, in the sense of the story anyhow. All right, we'll begin. Let's pray and then we'll get started. Father, thank you for this time. Bless our time together. I desire tonight to help us understand Esther and also grasp the tremendous story that we find embedded even in this story of Xerxes, his servants, our cabinet, I guess we would call them today, Mordecai, Esther. Help us to hear and learn, we ask in Christ's name. Amen. You may be seated. If you will look in your notes, the three references in the book of Esther to time, and they're very clearly pronounced. Chapter 1, which is, of course, the time of the feast and when Vashti is deposed, is in the 3rd year of his reign. I have, under the verses, I say that Xerxes had a lot going on between the fall of Vashti and the rise of Esther. And Xerxes' dates are from 486 BC to 465. He only reigned part of 486. So the only question we really have is, how are they dating 3rd, 7, and 12? Are they talking about the first full year, or are they talking about a part of a year? And to the answer to that question, I don't know. So the dating, if you want to write the dating in here, it will help you in a moment. The third year of his reign obviously would either be 483 or 482 BC, according to the part year, whole year. So Vashti was deposed in the third year, 483 or 482 BC. Chapter 2, verse 16 talks about when Esther is elevated. It was the seventh year of his reign. This would have been 479 or 478. I tend to lean towards 478, but it's just me. I tend to think they're probably counting full years, but it's impossible to know. So you have a time of 479 to 478. Then you go to chapter 3. Look, friends, he only reigned about 20 years. Chapter 3, when the bad guy is introduced, we're in the 12th year of his reign. He only has 8 years to live. And remember, chapter 3 and following takes about a year. And when you get to the end of that, he has 7 years to live. So the 12th year of his reign would be 474, 473, somewhere in that period of time. That is the structure of the book of Esther that the scripture gives you. Is that fair? All right. In your notes, I will read this quickly. Xerxes had a lot going on between the fall of Vashti and the rise of Esther. In 490, Darius, which was his father, or Darius the Great, whatever term you want to use, he got tired of the Greeks. Do we ever get tired of people in America? I think we got tired of somebody, well, some of us got tired of somebody recently and offed him. You have these people, and the Greeks were well known for causing problems. There was no place called Greece. Don't think Greece. Greeks. They had city-states. Athens, Sparta, several others. Some of the islands kind of considered themselves independent kingdoms. Friend, they fought for everybody. When the Persians fought against the Egyptians, they were fighting Greeks. When the Persians fought against the Egyptians, they had Greeks on their side. When they fought against the Greeks, the Persians had Greeks on their side. The Greeks were the mercenaries of that whole entire part of the world for a couple hundred years. I don't know why they were very good soldiers. Darius had had enough. So he decides to go in and put a hurt on the Greeks in 490. Specifically, and forgive me, oh my goodness, we have a city down where my sister lives, and I always get the pronunciations wrong. Athens, which down there they say Athens, right? Athens. Got it? Athens. So, he's going to go destroy the Athenians. In your notes, I say this. Darius the Great in the Battle of Marathon. Darius had 25,000 troops, infantry troops. He had 1,000 horse troops, cavalry. He had 600 ships. 50 horses, horse ships that transported horses, and 200 ships to transport supplies, and he's coming over to beat up on the Greeks, and the Greeks, the Athenians, have at most 10,000 men from Athens, and Plataeans, 1,000. And they're going to meet the greatest empire in history at that time, Darius. You say, I don't care about this stuff. Well, I do, so sorry. I'm not a military guy particularly, but I love this because the Greeks met Darius when he landed in the plains, and the plains was this. Any Filipino here gets this immediately. Just like in the Philippines, the Greeks, you have a little flat plain, ocean, flat plain, mountains. And the plain of Marathon was ocean, flat plain, and mountains. And one other thing, marsh, mud. Darius lands, He's going to put his troops together. He's got this massive army. At the most, the Athenians had had this small group of 10,000, which is at the most a third or so of the group. But he didn't know about the marsh in the mud. The Greeks lined up. Have you heard the story? The hoplites in formation, and they did the unthinkable. It had never been done before. They charged, and the Persians got scared, and the center collapsed. And when the center, oh, by the way, they had sent the guy on marathon, the run, he got down to Sparta, and that's when they said, sorry, we're busy. Have you ever asked somebody to go someplace, and every time you ask them, they say they're busy? I could name this. I won't go any further. We're busy. We're having a festival. We'll get back to you. This is part of what happens 100 years later in the fight between between Athens and Sparta. But anyhow, when they charge, the hoplites charge, this is what Herodotus said. They charged, the Persians broke, and the Persians in a matter of minutes lost 6,400 men. They lost 7 ships, and Darius tucked his tail and ran. The Athenians lost 192 men, and 11 of the Plataeans died. Was this a victory? You say, why do I care about this? Hold on. Darius went back to Persia, and he says, I'm going to smash those Greeks. I'm going to build the largest army that's ever happened. Rebellion broke out down in Egypt. He had to go down there and fight against the Egyptians and Greeks, of course, because they're all over the place fighting everybody. He gets down there. He squashes that. Darius dies, and now he has a son who wants to do what? The largest army in the ancient world up to that time, Xerxes, has the large. Now, Herodotus gives numbers that are ridiculous, two point something million men. Could not have been that many men. That's an impossibility. But even scholars today say 100,000. He brought them overland to Persia. He brought right in through the ocean. He brought ships with equal amount of people and supplies. And he's going to destroy those Greeks. Wait a minute. Who's Xerxes? He's the king we're talking about. Year 3, when Vashti is deposed, he's having what? He's having a feast. At that feast, what is he doing? Showing the splendor of his kingdom and getting his people ready for war. In 481 to 480, he takes his troops up. Remember, Macedonia wasn't part of this equation. Brings them over, and he finds the Greeks again at a little pass. This is the reason I love history. A little pass at Thermopylae. Some people say it was 50 feet wide. The Persian army was so many Persians. Leonidas, the Spartan, there were 300 of them. There was also several other groups. But the main group was 300 guys held a pass for 3 days. They held the pass. You know the story about Leonidas. His name means son of a lion. Leonidas, they said to him, they have so many archers, they'll blot out the sun. Leonidas said, then we'll fight in the shade. Do you understand those kind of men? When they finally come up the second day, Xerxes said to Leonidas, I don't think it was personal. He said, lay down your weapons, we'll let you leave. We'll let you live. And I said this Wednesday night, the most famous two Greek words in the Greek language to me, manon labe. Leonidas said, come and take them. Can I tell you something? If you're a man here tonight, if you're a man, you understand that. If someone was going to affect your family, what would a man do? Come and take them. Maybe that doesn't move you. When I was a kid, that moved me. It still does. Most of you know Leonidas was betrayed by a local person. Went around behind him on the third day, They're in front and back. They kill all of them, of course. That's not the problem. Xerxes has the biggest army in that period of time. He goes to a naval battle, Salamis, and Xerxes' navy is destroyed. You say, why do I care? I'm coming there. And then he has another battle in 479 at Plataea. And what happens when he's there? His army is destroyed, and the greatest Persian army to ever march west goes home. And when he gets home, he wakes up and says, I don't have a wife. Welcome to Esther chapter 2. In between Esther chapter 1 and Esther chapter 2 is the defeat of his great, mighty army. You say, doesn't say that in the text. I got news for you. It doesn't say that in the entire Persian world. They never mentioned they lost a battle. We look at the text. This is the background. Chapter 1 is in preparation for the war. Chapter 2 was after a great loss. And that is the background of chapter 1 and chapter 2. So when you're in chapter 1, we're having feasts to show the glory of my kingdom. And in chapter 2, we're depressed and we remember, I don't have a wife. We're going to talk about Mordecai tonight. Number one, Mordecai, a man born in the diaspora. Chapter 2, verse 5 says, now in Susa, the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimea, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, carried away. So I'm going to give you these bullet points. This is the background of Mordecai. First of all, Mordecai was Jewish. It says that in the text. I'm going to ask my friend Frenchie a question that he already knows because he answered earlier. Frenchie, when in chapter 6, when Mordecai is honored, does the king know he's Jewish? So Mordecai's Jewishness was not hid. Even the king knew. Now there's a difference between the daughter. Next, his name, he was named Mordecai. I only say that they've actually found quite a few people with that name. That name was not uncommon among Jewish people at that time. He's part of, or he's in the diaspora. Diaspora is a semi-technical term. Any Jewish person understands. If you're part of the diaspora, what are you? You are not in the promised land. You have been spores. You have been sown throughout the world. Diaspora means being sown. So if you're not in the promised land as a Jewish person, you're part of the diaspora. He was part of the diaspora, obviously. He was not in the promised land. He descended from three generations before him in the diaspora. I believe up in chapter 2, verse 5, we get his family. It was Mordecai, he was the son of Jair, which was the son of Shimea, which was the son of Kish. So we have three generations before him that were part of the diaspora. His great-grandfather, at least from my reading of this text, was part of the second Babylonian exile. In 598 or 597 B.C., and I have a misspelling here, Frenchie, you should have caught that. 598 and 597 B.C., somewhere in there. So you have three exiles. Daniel was exiled first and the upper class. To the right, Ezekiel, which was part of his family. Mordecai's family was exiled at this time. And the middle class. And then you have those remnants left over for the final exile, destruction of the temple, which was Jeremiah and the lowest class. Just the poor people and a few others. So there were three of these. His great-grandfather was part of the second Babylonian exile. He's of the tribe of Benjamin. So we even know his tribe. He's of the same tribe and descendant as King Saul. King Saul was a Benjamite, and King Saul, his father was named Kish. We'll talk about that more later. He was part, at this time, of the palace retinue, or part of the palace something. We don't know exactly what he did at this exact moment. So, who was Mordecai? Jewish guy, fourth generation, born in the diaspora, descended from people that came, you know, from the second exile. So he's been in this exile, his family's, for a long time. Number two. Now, friend, I hope when you read this story, and I hope by the time I'm done tonight, if everything else combobbles your head, if everything else means nothing to you, you'll understand what the text says about Mordecai. Now, for me, it's very important for me to know the background of this whole story. But, friend, if this isn't your thing, you understand what kind of man was Mordecai, and the text leaves no question. None. Mordecai, a man controlled by duty, and I like the second word, honor. When we're introduced to Esther, we're first introduced to Mordecai. It says in verse 7, he brought up Hadassah. Hadassah is the Hebrew word for myrtle or myrtle tree. That is Esther. Esther comes probably from the word star or something to that effect. It's this, he brought her up, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took, this is the most honorable statement I think you can find any place, as what? Stepdaughter? Red-headed stepchild? I have heard people say, this one's my child, but this one here we adopted. Or this one's mine, but this one here, she's not, or he's not. Look at me, friend. The most honorable thing you'll ever find in this text is whatever Mordecai was, he had a person in his family that he adopted, and she became his daughter. We don't know if Mordecai was married. We have no information about his own life, just him. In your notes, chapter 2, verse 15. Now when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his... It keeps saying this. Do you think the scripture says something twice for no purpose? He didn't just take care of her. He took her for his daughter. Wow. 2:20. Esther had not yet showed her kindred, nor her people, as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther did the commandment of Mordecai, like as when she was brought up with him. I say in your notes this statement, it is always a fair question to ask who a person is, their character, their motives, or you could say their heart. However, the book of Esther reveals almost no motives or motivations. So when you read the book of Esther, you're not going to, I mean, Mordecai's not going to say, now let me take two chapters to tell you how I feel about Esther. But in the story, well, like, let me give you the rest here. So you don't get a lot of that, but the book of Esther does reveal actions and details. So in the actions and the details of the text, we learn something extremely important about Mordecai. What do we find? Well, here it is. Mordecai brought up Hadassah, or Esther. Next, Esther was his cousin. From the text, you're assuming, and I'm assuming, probably a much younger cousin. Doesn't appear that it's someone of similar age. You know, she's probably a kid. He's probably... When I did my grandmother's funeral, it was the easiest funeral I've ever spoken at and the most difficult. There are 38 cousins. The problem is I'm about number 8, 9, 10, somewhere there. So all the top 10 or so knew exactly every story I told. But many of them didn't hardly know Grandma because they were little. I think she was the little one. He was one of the older cousins. You know, I mean, very much different in age. At least from the text, that's what you assume. Next. I'm not saying anything real profound here. Esther's parents had died. Mordecai then brought her up. And it should have been highlighted. It will be in the notes. Mordecai then brought her up, and Mordecai brought her up as what? Everybody tell me. Have you ever done anything? Please look at me. Have you ever done anything that you didn't have something to gain from it? When our children were young, my wife worked way too much to put our kids through Bob Jones. Way too much. She had way too many piano students to try to help our kids out. But look at me. Do I appreciate that? Yes. But that was my children's what? Mother. Yes? Is that honorable? Well, of course. It's honorable because I'm sure we have grandparents in here that have helped their grandchildren, and that's honorable. Do you understand he did not need to do anything for this girl? She was some cousin. Dada, when you go back to the Philippines, if they think you're from America, how many cousins do you have? Ade is going to Cameroon, or if he ever gets there, he's run into a brick wall. But his problem when he goes to Cameroon, he told me, he said, one time I went there and I decided I didn't want to give people gifts all day. He says, I never met any of these people. And he says, I got to the house early in the morning, slept 4 or 5 in the morning. There were people lined up for a mile. Look at me, relatives. Let's read these texts together. I understand, honor thy father and thy mother. They're the ones that did something for you. I understand Deuteronomy 6, which is what it means to bring up your children. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. I get it. Next page. And let me say this. I already know there's people in this room taking care of grandchildren. And I honor you. But I got a question for you. Why did Sharon Vasilovich and Pete Vasilovich spend tens of thousands of dollars helping people that were not related to them ever? Why did Floyd Smith, there's only one other person in this room that knows these stories. She knows them better than me. Why did Floyd Smith give tens of thousands of dollars to put people through Bible college who never wrote a single thank you note? Can I get an amen, sister? I'm asking you a question. Do you understand honor? That old man that stood out there, he didn't want anybody to know what he did. So I'm not trying to be cruel. He didn't give money through the offering. He made sure you didn't know. Because that old man wanted to help people anonymously. People that had no connection to him other than it was an honorable thing for that old man that used to sit right by Rhonda, so to speak. Do you understand those kind of people? Let me say something, friend. Yes, if you're not loyal to your children, you're not worth chucking out. As my dad would say, you're not worth your salt. Did you grow up with a father like that? That's what my dad would say. If you don't take care of your children, you're not worth your salt, which means you're worthless. Why do people help people who have no connection to them? I'm asking you. Some of us give $10. We want the whole world to know. If we gave $1,000, we'd put a sign. I gave $1,000. How about this? How about Mordecai that brought a young lady up that really he didn't need to bring up? He did it for what? He was an honorable man. You get that from reading the text. He brought her up as his own. Oh, by the way, you understand the ancient world? He could have brought her up as a servant, fed her, and look at me, and used, I'm not even talking about immoral, just used her.
He brought her up as his daughter. Oh, Ray over here.
You know, Ray's an easygoing guy, but I think if you got on the wrong side of his daughters, he wouldn't like you. If you got on the wrong side of Louis,
after you died and went to heaven, may I say that to both? And there's every man in this room is pretty much that way. Hear me. I get that. But what about for people you don't have any connection with? Do you all understand that?
Wow.
And some of you thought that old man just sat over there and was nice and couldn't hear. Mm-hmm. While he was giving thousands of his own dollars to help people who never bothered to write a thank you note. Wow. We continue. Back page, please. 1 Timothy 5. The King James is a little fuzzy here, so I'm going to give you some pretty precise language. If you're reading the ESV, it gives you a word that's true, but it's not the truth. So if that makes sense to you. 1 Timothy 5 talks about widows. It says, but if any widow have children, tekna, that's the word for children, or in the King James really butchers this one, nephews, engona means those who have descended from you. In the most languages, we'll say grandchildren, but it doesn't mean just grandchildren. It means somehow these people have descended from you. In some fashion, maybe it's grandchildren, maybe it's great-grandchildren, but they have in some ways, engona is the word for descended from you. The next word's very interesting. It doesn't use the normal word for parents. It goes ahead and says this, let them learn first to show piety at home and to requite or to pay back their, well, that word there is the word we get progenitors from, you know, those. So you have both sides, those who are producing the descendants and the descendants, both directions. We have responsibilities. My wife works very hard to take care of her mother. It's not easy. It's not fun. It's not fun to even watch my wife do it. You say, what does that mean? If just to watch her give my mother-in-law medicine for an hour every night and have to tell her like a child, breathe. Breathe deep. But I understand it because it's a daughter loving her mother. Mordecai had no reason. Have you ever met somebody that it's a second marriage? How do they treat the other kids? I'm going to say this. I've said it before. This is the first two people, this one and that one, that I've ever met that don't mistreat their stepchildren. You didn't hear me. That's the first ones. I think, Bambi, you would probably say your dad was that way. But I'm going to say this to you, friend. It is very uncommon for people that have stepchildren not to treat them as... Mm-hmm. See, you're wound up, Pastor Warren. Yes, I like this guy. 1 Timothy 5:8. On the other hand, but if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, this is the deal breaker, friend. This breaks all the religion. He or she has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. You don't call them Christian. If you won't take care of your children and vice versa, you won't take care of your parents and grandparents, we have a problem. This is a matter of honor. This is what Mordecai's taking care of some distant relatives. Next. I've already said this. Mordecai didn't have to bring her up. He was the father. He didn't have to be. And I always honor people that do those things they don't have to do. Does that make sense to you, friend? I want to tell this story only because I like to tell it. How many years ago? How old is John, Amy? 30? Is he 35? Be 36 soon. He must have been 6 years old. Every day since birth, we would always do the same things. Jenny had her routines at night. I had my routines in the night. They would come to me, then she'd put them to bed. And my children were perfect, so they always went willingly. And they never left the lights on and never got under the covers. They didn't do any. My children were perfect. But I remember one night telling John, I always told him, I love you. I'm glad I'm your dad. I'm glad you're my son. I'm glad Jesus gave you to me. Every night. Did the same with Amy. Amy, did I do that? I mean, this isn't religion. I did it. I wanted to do it. I remember one of the first times I looked at John and said, John, I don't love you. His head popped up and he said something like this, Dad, you have to love me. You're my dad. Wait a minute. Esther could never look at Mordecai and say, Mordecai, you have to love me. He chose, look at me, he chose to love this woman. I think that's beautiful. I hope you like it. Mordecai was an actual father. So he wasn't a father nominally, in name. You say, what does a father do? A father brings up their children. You say, does a father tell the children what to do? Yes. It's part of what a father does. I'm not going to read this for time. And I'm not going to comment on this other than to give you this next one. Mordecai brought up a beautiful feminine daughter. Several times in the text itself says, in the King James, something like she was fair. But the idea meaning is she was both pretty and she looked like a woman. She didn't look like she was from the 1800s. She looked attractive, the way God wants our young ladies to look. She didn't look like a prostitute. She didn't look like she was from the 1800s. She was attractive and feminine. How about that? God is not into this androgynous or the prostitute look or the 1800s look. None of them having to do with Christianity. But I'll let you deal with that. Next. Mordecai, and this is where we transition, was a father with limitations. You say, what do we mean? We can't always protect our children. Atong, I got a question for you. Has that ever scared you? I'm trying to think. You have two lovely daughters. They're always sweet. All right. They're always sweet in my fantasy, okay, Atong? That's how I think of them. When I think of them, sweet. First year in college, anything happened that you had no control over, Atong? Does that still scare you? My dad used to say to me this. He said, Ralph, you never made me afraid when you were home because I could always take care of things. When you got away from home, I couldn't take care of you anymore. Ladies, that scares your dad. Scares every dad. Every dad. In your notes, we can't always protect our own. And the next part of the story is what? Proof that he cannot protect his own. All right, we have to hurry. Number three, Mordecai, a man concerned about Esther, his daughter. Do you want to know what, by the way, do you want to know what Mordecai thought about Esther becoming queen? I think you know in this verse. Do you hear a father? Mordecai walked once a month. He walked every day before the court of the women's house. Why? To know how Esther did and what should become of her. I say with this, we must come to the elephant in the room. What was Esther's frame of mind and what was Esther sinning when she married this pagan? And I'm going to give you my best analysis. We're going to do it quickly. And look at me, I'm not going to give you opinions, I'm going to give you the text. I think the text is important. So let's look at the highlighted sections. The Battle of Thermopylae is over, the Battle of Plataea is over, the Battle of Salamis is over, Xerxes has come home, he now wants a big queen, so he has a beauty contest, rounds up a bunch of women, and here's where it begins. Look at verse 2. Then said the king's servants that ministered to him, we would call those people his cabinet, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom. What were they going to be doing? Looking, being on the lookout for pretty girls. Yes or no? I read a book about Saddam Hussein who did this just recently before he was killed.
Before we went into Iraq, I had read a book. Pete Vasilovich gave it to me. He had groups of guys go through all the cities, and he would look for pretty girls that they found attractive. And they didn't ask, would you like to see Saddam? Okay? You say, this is gross. This is a reality you ought to be thanking God you don't live in. We continue. So, it says, virgins sought for the king. Verse 3, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of the kingdom that they may gather together. Tim, when I read this, it sounds to me like what my dad would say. Go round up the cows. Now, if you didn't grow up on a farm, you don't know what that means. But at nighttime, you had to go find the animals. You had sometimes bring them back. I mean, it just said, go gather some people up. All the fair young virgins unto Susa the palace. Verse 4. And let the maidens which pleaseth the king. Boy, everything is about the king here. Be queen instead of Vashti. And the thing pleased the king. Boy, everything is about his ego. And he did so. So it came to pass when the king's, what's this next word? Suggestion? Preference? His commandment and decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together unto Susa the palace, again, you just have that, it sounds like they were just herded. You had people out, found lots of pretty girls. Kind of, can you imagine? Now, for Filipinos here, you know enough about be your grandparents. Filipinos were hiding their pretty daughters during World War II, sending them up into the mountains. I've heard of many folks, young, they're now in their 80s now, but when they were kids in World War II, their parents sent them up into the mountains. Why? Because they liked the mountains. Yes. We continue. Verse 11, and what did Mordecai think about all this mess? We don't have to pray, do we? It says, and Mordecai walked every day before the court of the woman's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her. Now, you all know the story. We'll skip all the story and go down to the thoughts. We might come back to the story more at a different time or maybe Wednesday. Let me give you some basic concluding thoughts about this. All this language leaves all the young virgins passive. Do you know what it means, passive? Yes or no? They were not active participants, none of them. Now, that doesn't mean none of them wanted to go. It's just the language of the text is, go gather together all the pretty girls that you guys see, send out people looking for them, and gather them together. There's no indication that any young lady, this is next in your notes, however you want to write it, I don't even know how I have it written, I don't think any of them gave consent. I don't think it was about consent. He was the king of the world. He wanted a wife. Go gather some young pretty ones up for me. So when you read the story, every indication is the ladies are passive in the story. There's no consent here. They weren't saying, boy, this is wonderful. Next. Esther's heart, of course, is not revealed. We don't have anything about how she felt. But we do have what Mordecai was doing, don't we? Mordecai was very concerned every single day. And in Hebrew, it could be every day, kind of like all day. He kept going over to find out how Esther was doing. Think about it, men. You have a daughter. Would you not want to know what was going on? Now, friend, I was in Golconda, which is a fortress in southern India, a Muslim fortress, when I was there last year, a little bit earlier than this time. I saw where they kept the wives of the king. It was a big, beautiful, big, huge building still there, and this was probably 500-600 years old. You became one of his concubines, whatever you call them, wife, concubine, whatever, play toy. You got stuffed in there. Nobody ever saw you again. That's the reason in chapter 4, Esther talks to Mordecai through what? Go-betweens. Exactly. All right. Mordecai was obviously very concerned. I'm going to speak about Esther. I'll give you some suggestions, but they're merely suggestions. As with most people forced into something even remotely similar, in every indication in the text,
Esther really didn't have choices. You said she could have died. Okay, but other than that, she didn't have much of a choice. Here, and I'm going to read this way across the top. I'm going to guess her thoughts were this. Fear. Young ladies, do you think you would be afraid? Answer the question. Would you be afraid? You were rounded up from wherever you were and brought to the palace. Fear would be part of it. Next, probably shame. Probably. Now, don't anybody throw anything at me. There was probably also excitement. Do you realize that most of us can have more than one emotion at the same time? And by the way, if you're going to be possibly being the queen of the world, maybe there was excitement with the shame, with the fear. Maybe, what is God doing? Has anything ever happened in your life and you thought, what is God doing? If Esther was a believer, I think she was. Though it never says it in the text, I think it's fair to say she probably was wondering, what's God doing here? There was probably hope. You know what hope is, friend? It's when you're put into a situation you don't have a choice about. And you hope. You hope for the best, yes? If you don't, what are your options if you're not hoping for the best? What is his? Our missionary, let me think what their name is. Lopez in Spain. I don't think I've said this. I'm assuming you get their missionary letter. They have a daughter in Michigan, third daughter, major cancer right now. So let me ask you a question. You have a daughter. You're in a missionary in Spain. Your daughter's in America. What are you thinking? And what is she thinking? By the way, when you read her text, I read the text, Amy, that you sent me. She's got a lot of bravado. Because you got cancer. What are you going to do? Shoot yourself? So she just hopes. We continue. There might have been resignation. If you find out you can no longer do something, do you just resign yourself to this? I've talked to Dr. Marriott. Mike, you were there. Dr. Marriott's doing well, but he's also resigned to the fact that this is kind of the way it is. I don't have an eye. And did he say it to you? I can't remember where we were. He says it was my dominant eye, too. Well, what are you going to do? The answer is resignation. Move on. Next, confused. I would guess, maybe tempted, and I can almost guarantee you I'm using two different ways of saying the same thing. She was conflicted. Or in tension. She was put in a spot that you just don't want to be in. Does everybody agree with that? Now, because of time tonight, look at me. I'm not going to say anything else, and I'm not going to read all the verses, but Esther was put into a place that people get put into. What do you do? Let's look at the front page, go over the big bullet points, and we'll finish. Mordecai, a man born in the diaspora. A man controlled by what? Duty and what? And his honor showed up in being a father to people he didn't need to be a father to. Mordecai, a man concerned about Esther, his daughter. Wow. Every day, and maybe even all day, he's as close as he can get to where Esther's at, hoping for the best, maybe praying for the best. Well, the story, of course, which is going to be major in the rest of this whole story, is Mordecai, a man privy to a plot. He hears some men plotting to take the king's life. He tells Esther, look with me, please. He tells Esther, she tells the king, they kill the two guys, they hang them, and hang them, don't think this. Hang them, think this. Spike, do I need to say anything else? Do not think, because you see the word hang, of what we have done in the West with a rope. They were impaled. If you read chapter 9, you'll figure this out, because they kill
Haman's sons, and they hang them later. But what's the story hinge on? And I'm done tonight. They wrote it in the chronicle of the kings of Persia. And later on in the story, the king can't sleep. And he says, will you bring me that history book? You know, the stuff I never like to hear that puts me to sleep? And he hears, he reads about who? Mordecai. And he says, has anything been done for Mordecai? And they say, no. And he says, who's in the palace? And the whole story hinges on what the very last part of chapter 2 happens. Mordecai hears something, tells Esther, which tells the king, which takes action, which writes it down. And the Jews, in many ways, are protected because he was in the right place at the right time. Father, thank you for this night. Bless our time together.